You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Before we hear today's passage, I want to invite you to take a second to conjure up the image of every Walgreens or Hallmark nativity scene that you've got emblazoned in your memory, and then set it aside. The Christmas story we're about to hear is not some quiet, soft-focus visage. There are no shepherds gathered under starry skies, no pink-cheeked cherubs fluttering around a glowing manger. In fact, there's no manger at all. You don't need a manger when there are no animals. Matthew gives us a very different picture of Jesus' birth, a story full of danger, intrigue, paranoia, manipulation, death squads, and families running for their lives. Most scholars agree that the author of Matthew was writing in the late 80s or early 90s, nearly 100 years after Jesus would have been born, and years after the Roman destruction of the temple in 70. It was a time when people of the region would have been reeling from violence, displacement, and an overwhelming sense of vulnerability. Living in the shadow of Rome's crushing power, Matthew's community would have known what state surveillance felt like. They knew what it was to be treated as expendable by the machinery of empire. Fear was the background noise of everyday life. So, when the author of Matthew tells the story of Jesus' birth, it's not framed as some sweet and fluffy escape from reality, but as an episode any one of them could relate to. Remember, Matthew is written for a predominantly Jewish audience, and throughout the book, Jesus is cast as the new Moses. So, listen for how the story is deliberately told to echo the story of the Exodus. An infant marked as a threat, a paranoid ruler who responds to fear with violence, a massacre of children, and a family fleeing under cover of darkness. Herod is the stand-in for Pharaoh. Jesus is set in the mold of Moses, and the Holy Family becomes the archetype of the political refugee, forced to escape across borders to stay alive. And then there are the Magi, astrologers from the East. They're outsiders, spiritual seekers, academics following clues towards new insights. Yet, in their naivete, they're pulled into the vortex of a mad king's paranoia. They're manipulated into becoming unwitting informants in a plot to eliminate a political rival. Earnest spiritual seekers weaponized in the service of shoring up an autocrat's delusions of grandeur. Pay attention also to Joseph. No words, but he pays attention to what he hears in the quiet. He trusts his gut and acts decisively, courageously, even subversively. Despite the danger, he refuses to let his family be crushed by empire and flees to a foreign country. But not everyone escapes. Matthew draws from Jeremiah in conveying the lament of those who are caught up in circumstances beyond their control. Rachel, weeping for her children, is an integral part of the Christmas story, but more often than not, left out, insulating us from the reality of human suffering so we can maintain a sanitized, saccharine strain of all is calm, all is bright, misdirecting us from exposure to the deeper meaning of the story. So, as you hear our passage today, listen for the collision of worlds, empire and vulnerability, paranoia and courage, violence and resistance, and your childhood memory of the story versus what's actually in the text. From the very beginning, Matthew is laying out how the very existence of this Jesus character threatens a very old order, and that what we think of as Christmas is not the story of wondrous signs and the miracle of Jesus being slipped out of harm's way, but of circumstances that are echoed in our own world right now and challenges us to compare our own actions today with the courageous risk takers in our story. And if you're still clinging to quaint after hearing what the text really says, you're clearly not paying attention.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew, chapter 2, verses 1 through 18, the Message version.
After Jesus was born in Bethlehem village, Judah territory, this was during Herod's kingship, a band of scholars arrived in Jerusalem from the east. They asked around, "Where can we find and pay homage to the newborn king of the Jews? We observed a star in the eastern sky that signaled his birth. We're on pilgrimage to worship him."
When word of their inquiry got to Herod, he was terrified. And not Herod alone, but most of Jerusalem as well. Herod lost no time. He gathered all the high priests and religion scholars in the city together and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?"
They told him, "Bethlehem, Judah territory. The prophet Micah wrote it plainly. It's you, Bethlehem, in Judah's land, no longer bringing up the rear. From you will come the leader who will shepherd rule my people, my Israel."
Herod then arranged a secret meeting with the scholars from the east. Pretending to be as devout as they were, he got them to tell him exactly when the birth announcement star appeared. Then he told them the prophecy about Bethlehem and said,
"Go find this child. Leave no stone unturned. As soon as you find him, send word, and I'll join you at once in your worship."
Instructed by the king, they set off. Then the star appeared again, the same star they had seen in the eastern skies. It led them on until it hovered over the place of the child. They could hardly contain themselves. They were in the right place. They had arrived at the right time.
They entered the house and saw the child in the arms of Mary, his mother. Overcome, they kneeled and worshiped him. Then they opened their luggage and presented gifts: gold, frankincense, myrrh.
In a dream, they were warned not to report back to Herod. So they worked out another route, left the territory without being seen, and returned to their own country.
After the scholars were gone, God's angel showed up again in Joseph's dream and commanded,
"Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Stay until further notice. Herod is on the hunt for this child and wants to kill him."
Joseph obeyed. He got up, took the child and his mother under cover of darkness. They were out of town and well on their way by daylight. They lived in Egypt until Herod's death. This Egyptian exile fulfilled what Hosea had preached, "I called my son out of Egypt."
Herod, when he realized that the scholars had tricked him, flew into a rage. He commanded the murder of every little boy 2 years old and under who lived in Bethlehem and its surrounding hills. He determined that age from information he'd gotten from the scholars. That's when Jeremiah's revelation was fulfilled.
"A sound was heard in Ramah, weeping and much lament. Rachel weeping for her children. Rachel refusing all solace. Her children gone, dead and buried."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
It's disorienting, isn't it? The split screen of this season. On one side, we're unpacking Christmas decorations, humming along to O Little Town of Bethlehem, and on the other side, our news feeds are full of Gaza in ruins and Palestinians struggling to survive. We're untangling Christmas lights while families in the land of Jesus' birth are scrambling for food, water, and shelter. It feels spiritually dishonest to pretend we don't see it, as if singing Silent Night loud enough could drown out the air raid sirens. Yet here we are, American Christians tossing around peace on earth platitudes while Bethlehem and Gaza bear witness to anything but. And if Matthew is any guide, this is not a new story. Matthew's Christmas is not sentimental. It's not quiet. It's not safe. It's a story of paranoid rulers, manipulated spiritual seekers, refugee families, government death squads, and mothers whose grief tears the sky open. It is a gospel that mirrors the world we find ourselves in right now. Back in 1986, the year before the First Intifada, and decades before 30-foot-tall razor wire top walls, biometric checkpoints, and AI surveillance suffocating most Palestinians today, I found myself in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve. In my naivete, I had imagined some vague, manger-adjacent holiness transporting me to a spiritually electric, hope-filled, candlelit moment of bliss. Instead, I got metal detectors, pat-downs, twice, and Uzis. Lots and lots of Uzis. And there it was, surrounded by heavily armed, fidgety IDF teenagers. Manger Square was jammed with pilgrims from all over the world. Tourists, clergy, and spiritual looky-loos serenaded by a cacophony of choirs of every stripe trying to outsing their counterparts. Of course, none of us had any hope of entry into the Church of the Nativity's Midnight Mass. That was an invitation-only affair for celebrities, dignitaries, and special guests. You know, just like the first Christmas. And there I was, before the uprisings, before the containment walls, before the proliferation of checkpoints. You could feel occupation in the air, in the posture of the soldiers, in the nervousness of the crowd. Whatever the nod towards peace on earth, it was strictly seasonal, performative, and very conditional. Matthew's Bethlehem seemed very present. It didn't take long for my friends and I to determine that this was not the Christmas Eve we'd been looking for. We jostled our way out of the square, away from the "this is where it happened" frenzy, and took a cab back to our dorm on the southern edge of Jerusalem. Restless and still hoping for a less than traumatic Christmas Eve, we wandered through the dimly lit streets towards what was then the undeveloped edge of town. Before long, we found ourselves on a hillside in a field between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, quiet, windswept, and startlingly peaceful. Soon we found ourselves clambering up onto the half-buried remnants of a bunker and trench system left over from the Six-Day War. We climbed up the shattered concrete and twisted rebar and sat on top of the ruins. Sitting on that bunker, I felt the full weight of the place. Revered as some symbolic wellspring of peace, it's almost never known it. Taking in the starlight and silence, I remember feeling a sense of awe. Not the sentimental Hallmark kind, but the all-too-real awareness of just how fragile any experience of peace human beings can ever expect. Then, as now, Bethlehem and the West Bank are under siege, and we remain hapless witnesses to the continued gutting of Gaza, shattered by relentless bombing, displacement, starvation, and the kind of collective punishment international law pretends to prohibit, but seldom prevents. The scale of suffering is incomprehensible, but the story remains the same. Those in power act out of fear and dominance. Those without power are crushed beneath it. And in the meantime, most Christians continue to embrace the nativity stories as some sort of sweet, uncomplicated bedtime tales, when in fact they are stories of imperial occupation, military aggression, and the desperation of a refugee family forced to navigate systems designed to humiliate and brutalize them. Look around. In different guise, Rome's iron fist is still in play. Herod's paranoia is still running rampant. The Holy Family's flight in pursuit of basic human dignity is a worldwide phenomenon. And yet, most American churches will continue to prattle the same old lessons and carols this Christmas, singing saccharine sweet carols and mouthing pious fairy tales stripped of any real-world relevance. A tranquilized Christmas for one and all. Not because the story is too ancient to matter, but because the story is too contemporary to face head-on. The historical Jesus wasn't born into a bucolic pastoral scene. He was born into the midst of systemic, state-sponsored paranoia and violence. Mary wasn't glowing serenely. She was exhausted, displaced, and navigating the kind of danger many women, not just immigrants, can relate to this very day. Joseph wasn't some picturesque handyman. He was likely a subsistence laborer trying to keep his family alive in the increasingly intrusive shadow of empire. Matthew places Jesus directly into the cogs of that machinery. Dennis H. Palmer's reimagined Away in a Manger captures the truth in a way the original lyrics avoid. When children are crying and mothers distressed, because those in power with greed are obsessed, we seek to find justice, compassion for them, because of Christ Jesus born in Bethlehem. That's Matthew's Christmas. It names the truth that the more familiar lyrics evade and affirms the fact that the birth of Jesus still happens, not among the comfortable, but the oppressed, not among the insulated, but among the endangered, not among those swathed in privilege, but among those enduring the unendurable. Now, progressive Christians get accused of politicizing Christmas, but the only way to politicize Christmas is to pretend it's not political. Matthew's story is full of politics, military occupation, government decrees, state-sponsored terror, manipulated advisors, a ruler whose fear fuels violence, refugees crossing borders for safety. To tell that story honestly is not bringing politics into Christmas. It's refusing to lie about Christmas. And even now, in a moment when cruelty feels ascendant, Israelis and Palestinians are locking arms in courageous acts of solidarity. Groups like Standing Together remind us that Israel is not a monolithic story any more than America is a monolithic story. There are those resisting empire's temptations right now, just as Joseph resisted Herod's commands and the Magi chose a different road.
There are 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Jews in this land, and none of us are going anywhere, and all of us deserve a real future.
A future of justice, freedom, and equality for all. A future where all of us can live with peace and security.
Our future is shared, and so are our interests. Our fate is intertwined. Our fight for Jewish security and Palestinian freedom is one voice of collective liberation.
A voice that demands an end to the occupation, an end to the siege, an end to the never-ending wars.
A voice that demands a start to something new, a completely new ground, a voice that imagines a pathway to a real, just peace.
We are the generation that chooses to build instead of destroy.
We are the generation that will fundamentally bring about the change for everyone that lives here.
This is the moment to act.
Join us now in the fight for a real future for all.
So don't let Christmas be sentimentalized away for yet another year. Embrace the story as an opportunity to act with moral clarity. Use it to reject every form of collective punishment. Leverage it to insist that the lives of Palestinian families are just as sacred as any others. Refuse to prioritize a metaphorical personal salvation over the suffering of real people. Challenge others to seek out practical, justice-based solutions for peace instead of hypothetical, sentimental, peace-on-earth platitudes. As I remember sitting on top of that starlit bunker all those years ago, longing for human beings to be something other than what we are, it's not just Gaza that breaks my heart and stirs my indignation. The same dynamics, fear, dehumanization, the justification of cruelty for our safety, show up in every ICE raid that targets families who have lived here for years, who have children in our schools, who contribute to our communities, and who suddenly find their lives shattered by uncertainty and a bureaucracy enamored of cruelty. As the ease with which we turn on one another is normalized, it's sobering to remember that the Romans mastered the art of dividing the populace with relatively primitive technology. Add cable news and social media algorithms to the craft, and demonizing people with different political opinions, treating neighbors as enemies, and trading genuine community for tribalism are threats that cannot remain unchallenged. Add to that the rising arrogance of our new American kleptocracy, where leaders hoard wealth while simultaneously insisting there's not enough for the poor, the sick, the migrant, or the marginalized, and the echoes of Herod's cling to power at any cost strategy seems frighteningly familiar. If we engage with the Christmas stories honestly, we discover that they're not just stories that indict the ancient world and usher in some cosmic superhero narrative. They indict any world where the powerful feed on the powerless and silence becomes the preferred language of the privileged. Matthew shows us that the divine does not align with empires, militaries, or oligarchs. The divine aligns with the families trying to survive them. And that is why the story still matters. So even in the midst of empire, may you find your own starlit field this Christmas. And there, may the Spirit give you courage to see clearly, to act boldly, and welcome the other wherever they may appear today. I'd like to wrap it up today with a different take on our usual stream of thought. So join me in this Christmas blessing for a wounded world. This Christmas, may we resist the urge to avoid the real story. May we refuse the narcotic of a sentimental peace. May we let discomfort sharpen our compassion rather than spark our defensiveness. May we see Gaza, Bethlehem, and our own communities through the same moral lens. May we resist every form of cruelty, whether wrapped in the language of national security, partisan hostility, or kleptocratic entitlement. May we become, in every way we can, people who protect the vulnerable rather than rationalize their suffering. And may the Christ we remember as a fragile, displaced, at-risk child awaken in us the courage to choose justice over comfort, truth over propaganda, and hope over cynicism. Be well.
Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.